Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. I'm Jasmine Smith, and Robert Connie is not joining me today because Robert and his wife Kelsey welcomed a baby girl, Louisa K. Connie, to the world on August 20th. So congratulations to them, and he will be taking a little bit of time off for paternity leave. But I'm happy to have a few guests for the next few weeks. It's going to be a very lawyer-heavy series in the podcast. So today, my first guest is Yvette De La Guardia. She has been on the podcast before, and we talked about the juvenile justice system. So we're going to talk a little bit more today about some criminal legal issues. And then, as always in 2020, our other two topics are COVID and the protests. So we'll go ahead and get started. So Yvette is here. Welcome back to My Old Kentucky Podcast. First, we're going to start with talking a little bit more about the criminal legal system. Last time you were here, we talked about youthful offenders. And for those who may not remember or don't know, those are juveniles who have been transferred to adult court to be tried and sentenced like adults. We talked about all the problems with youthful offender laws and why we and other experts believe that they're so harmful. But of course, those youthful offender laws are just one problem within the juvenile criminal system. So I wanted to ask you this time, what are some other reforms or overhauls that are important to you in the juvenile justice system and or, you know, in the criminal legal system as a whole?
Yeah, I think in the criminal justice system as a whole, something I'm interested in seeing develop a little bit more is the recognition of a group of people ages 18 to 25 being treated as they should be. In criminal law reform circles, that age group is called post-adolescents or emerging adults. And the idea is that those categories or ages of people are essentially an extension of juveniles. We know, this is something we talked about the last time I was on the podcast, that the brain is not finished developing until we're 25, and that our ability to make decisions and perceive long-term consequences and our vulnerability to peer pressure and different things like that isn't where it should be until 25. So you have an entire group of people, these 18 to 25-year-olds, who are getting in trouble and being funneled into a system that doesn't recognize that who they are when they made this mistake is not who they're going to be for the rest of their life. So recently, the Kentucky Supreme Court actually heard a case that sort of addressed this. It was Commonwealth versus Breadhold. The decision came out in March of 2020. I'm sure you've read it.
Yeah, and this is a capital case from Lexington.
Right. So in that case, it was Breadhold and then, like, I think maybe two other people who were all being tried on, I think, was it murder for everyone? I know it was for Breadhold.
Yeah, I believe it was all murder charges, and they were all between the ages of 18 and 20, I think.
Yeah, I think so, because in this case, the issue was whether it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment to have these persons who were all under 21 facing the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And our Supreme Court said this is not justiciable at the time.
Yeah.
So we don't really have an answer. I know that in June of 2020, the attorneys in this case did file a cert petition in the United States Supreme Court. So that's something that I'm really looking forward to seeing. I think that if the court does take it up, it would be very similar to the line of cases like Roper, Miller, Graham, the cases that talk about why we don't execute children anymore, why kids aren't eligible for the death penalty. So a lot of places throughout the world and even some states have recognized this emerging adulthood or post-adolescence group of people as its own distinct category of people, and one that should be treated differently from people whose brains are fully developed.
Yeah, so when you say that the Supreme Court of Kentucky said that the case wasn't justiciable, can you explain to listeners what that means?
So at the time the appeal in this case was filed, none of the defendants had been tried or convicted. So the death penalty was sort of just this possibility that could happen to them sometime in the future. The court doesn't, no appellate court will consider cases that don't have an injury to a party. So at the point that they filed the appeal in this case, the death penalty hadn't been imposed. So there wasn't, according to the Kentucky Supreme Court, there wasn't anything really for them to decide because the death penalty hadn't been imposed.
Right. So basically what the Supreme Court said here is you have to be convicted and given the death penalty before
you can challenge it.
You can challenge this, which is just a horrible thing for these kids to go through, I think, is, you know, you don't get an answer on this issue you've raised until you actually have been given the death penalty. And, you know, just what you're talking about with post-adolescence, I've been hearing about this same age group through, like, education people in education circles, and they call it disconnected youth. Hmm. Youth that is usually, like, 16 to 24 that they've kind of, like, lost in the school system, that have dropped out of school, or, you know, they don't know what happens to them after high school and there's no resources for them. And I think, you know, we're starting to talk about that age group in other circles, but not necessarily in the criminal legal system. And so I think that's a really important group to highlight, because the general public, I don't think, knows just, you know, how vast the difference is between being treated as a juvenile at 17 years old and then being treated as an adult with huge consequences, mm-hmm. just, you know, 6 months later, maybe.
Right. But what's important to remember, though, is the general public does know that 18 to 25 year olds are still just big kids.
Yeah.
That's why you mm-hmm. can't rent a car until you're 25. That's why you stay on your parents' insurance, if you're lucky and fortunate, until what is it, like 24?
26.
26. Mm-hmm. So what people in the criminal justice world are asking folks to consider is not something people don't already know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, there's the brain science that supports this sort of distinction, but there's also just the parenting paradigm, and the way that we treat these people now is different. So, like, at the beginning of the 1900s, it was not uncommon for you to turn 16, 17, 18 and to go out and get married and have a job. But it is not like that anymore.
It's definitely changed. So you've always been passionate about juvenile law, but now you do appellate work in the criminal legal system. So can you explain a little bit about what an appellate defense attorney does? Because I get this question a lot, and I think it's, like, obvious in the name that we do appeals, but not many people know what that entails, or, you know, when someone can appeal. So can you just explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, so an appeal is where you are saying to a higher court that sits above a trial court that you have been wronged. Whether that's some constitutional violation or a violation of some statute, there's some error that the trial court made that has affected you adversely. In Kentucky, you have a constitutional right to one appeal. It's called a matter of right appeal. And so, at least as far as criminal defense appellate attorneys go, you and I, we watch a lot of trials and we watch a lot of suppression hearings and read a lot of statutes. And then we do a lot of research, and we filed these written documents called briefs in the Kentucky Court of Appeals, which is the intermediate court, and the Supreme Court, which is the last stop for all Kentucky state appeals.
So, you know, as an appellate attorney, you're largely dealing with the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Kentucky most of the time. I think, you know, non-lawyers have some understanding of federal courts and who's on the Supreme Court, but may not know much about their own state appellate courts. So what do you think about, you know, the current appellate courts that we deal with?
Well, I think it's important to sort of understand what the court looks like first. So
yeah.
In Kentucky, like I said, our intermediate appellate court is called the Kentucky Court of Appeals. We have 14 judges. Seven are men, seven are white men, seven women, five of them are white and two are black, And then our Kentucky Supreme Court has 7 justices, 4 men all white, and 3 women all white. In the Kentucky Supreme Court, you have 1 justice for each of Kentucky's 7 districts. And they are elected positions, and they serve for 8-year terms. Appellate courts are also elected positions. So as to what I think about Kentucky's appellate courts, I do think that it's lacking in diversity. I think diversity is something that's really important to have in your judiciary because different perspectives, I think, help bring about good outcomes. And so that's something that I would like to see, but of course we would need more people of color running for these elected positions.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked about these being elected positions, and I think it's sometimes really hard to get information about judicial races. So for people who, you know, will be voting in appellate court races, like the Supreme Court District 7 race, you know, how can people decide who to vote for in these appellate court races?
I don't think that it's easy.
Yeah.
Because it's such a, I think people don't often think about who the appellate court judges are, because it seems something that you're so far removed from.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to know who to vote for, I think that you can have an informed opinion by just kind of digging into people's backgrounds. So a lot of the people who run for appellate court positions have experience as circuit trial judges, district trial judges, and they have written orders and they've made rulings before. So I think if you ask people in your community what they know about a certain candidate, and the people that you'd be asking would, you know, be people probably at the courthouse, that's a good place to start. I know it's not easy, but Google is always a good place to start. I wish that there was more attention in these races. I know that sometimes and you expect at least people to have, like, debates and things like that, but I just don't think that that's something that happens very often.
Yeah, and because they're nonpartisan, campaigning is just a little bit different for these races. But, you know, I think we saw a fairly partisan race within the last year with Whitney Westerfield and Shay Nickel running for a Supreme Court seat. And, you know, Whitney Westerfield kind of made it that way. He ran on, like, his slogan was, like, a constitutional conservative. And so these races aren't always super political, but I feel like in the last couple years, they have been that way, like, more than in the past.
Well, and the reason that I think they don't, obviously I'm not a judge, I can't speak with any amount of certainty, but I think that they don't share that kind of stuff because judges are supposed to be these completely impartial, unbiased arbiters of justice.
Yeah.
And so when you have someone who is saying, hey, when I get on the bench, all my decisions are going to be made on these, like, ideological lines, that should be a red flag.
Yeah.
People are who are voted on the court are supposed to not prejudge cases. They're supposed to listen objectively and then rule. So I think that that's what you should be looking for.
Yeah. So switching gears from appellate issues a little bit, so there are a lot of new problems arising in criminal cases due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Can you highlight, you know, maybe a few constitutional problems that incarcerated and charged individuals might be facing right now?
Yeah, I think early on, one of the concerns was the constitutional right to a speedy trial, which is exactly what it sounds like. You don't have to, you're not supposed to sit incarcerated or waiting trial for years and years and years. It's supposed to happen fairly quickly. So I know when COVID first happened, everybody was really worried because trials were getting pushed back. People were sitting in jail without any relief, unable to post their cash bond, that whole thing that you talked about. But there's been a recent order that says trials can start back. So that's sort of shifted into, okay, so what constitutional rights do I need to be thinking about in COVID times for my client's trial, right? So I think one of those is you have a Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that means that you have a right to have a jury that's drawn from a fair cross-section of your community. That means that the people who were summoned to be drawn for your jury have to look like your community. And I think that because there's been a lot of research, I know the UN did a study, the CDC did a study, all showing that Black and brown people and women are disproportionately affected by COVID, the result of a trial at this time might mean that your right to a fair cross-section of the community is at risk.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I also see Sixth Amendment confrontation issues, too. Yeah. So, you know, you have the right to confront the witnesses against you. And I think, you know, trials over Zoom, people wearing masks, trial attorneys, you know, we look at witness reactions and body language and how they say things.
And
right. And so I think that that's another issue that we're going to see with trials resuming. And I think there's a really tough balance between, you know, do I want my speedy trial or do I want to wait until things are safer and I can have a more fair trial? And I think that's really tough for the charged individuals and attorneys to make that decision. Mm-hmm. All right. So my last question is a broad one. You know, Louisville passed a Breonna's Law ordinance, and then Attica Scott has also pre-filed a statewide Breonna's Law. And even Republicans have showed some support for no-knock warrant bans, chokehold bans, and things like that. And I think while these things are steps in the right direction, you know, what are other things that you see that need to be done to combat police brutality and prevent the killings of Breonna Taylor and David McAtee and just so many others?
Yeah, that's such a loaded question. You know, I think there's, as an attorney, there's some obvious things. Like, I know, at least here in Louisville, that the police have body cameras, and there's no reason that they shouldn't be wearing them. I think that statewide there could be reforms to qualified immunity, things like that. But ultimately, I think that while that may hold people accountable, I don't think when we use the word prevent, we're going to get anywhere close to that until and unless we listen to Black people.
All of these measures are just either like deterrent measures or accountability measures, but they don't necessarily change how we view things.
Yeah. And I know that Black people in America have been telling us about police brutality since the beginning.
Yeah.
This isn't anything new. We know that Sheriff Jim Clark in Alabama was using cow prods against nonviolent unarmed protesters, and that NYPD officers fired 41 shots at Amadou Diallo. So I think that we need to really believe and understand that this is a problem. It's not a point of view. It's not a myth or a theory. Mm-hmm. And we need to be listening to people who have dedicated their minds and their bodies and their lives to this work. And James Baldwin is a great place to start. Ta-Nehisi Coates, Ava DuVernay. Here in Louisville, we have Dr. Stephen Niffley, Keturah Hammond. Yeah. We have so many amazing, compassionate people who have been fighting this fight for so long. I think when we ask how do we make these changes, we need to look. I'm not wanting to put any pressure on them, but these are people who have been drawing awareness to this kind of stuff. I think that they're the ones who we should be listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate your perspective on that. And also, like, the other things that we've talked about, I feel like we've hit a lot of different legal issues here. So I appreciate talking with you and hope you'll stay to hit the other topics with me.
Sure.
Okay, so as always, our COVID-19 update. So this week, we're approaching 50,000 cases. Over the last week, case numbers have mostly ranged in the high 600s to 800s. Today, we had 696. With the two smaller days on Sunday and Monday. Until Sunday, we had seen six straight days of increases, and over the last week, 100 plus of the daily cases every day have been children. You know, I think a lot of districts have followed Bashir's recommendations to do virtual learning, but a lot of private schools have gone back to school. Youth sports are happening. So I think it's unsurprising that we're seeing more and more cases in kids. Also, in the past week, since we last talked to you, the decision was finally made to hold the Kentucky Derby without fans. Vet, do you think that was the right call?
Oh, gosh. I have my own views on the horse racing industry, honestly.
So you would rather it not be held at all.
I just outed myself against all these Kentuckians, but yeah.
That's okay. You know, I don't think that...
My dad's a jockey, even. My mom is a hot walker, so I say this with, like, full awareness of what goes on in the industry.
Yeah.
I think maybe I wasn't the best person to ask that, but...
Fair enough. I mean, I definitely think this is the right call. I don't think this will prevent people from having their own derby parties, so maybe we see some small outbreaks from derby parties, but it will absolutely prevent a huge influx of out-of-towners and thousands of people in one place.
Yes, I agree with... Yes, I'm with you there.
Yeah. Also this week, the federal government approved Bashir's application for a $400 per week supplement to employment benefits. So this comes after the $600 was ended in July, and so now $400 have been approved. The new payments, though, only apply to people who were unemployed between July 26th and August 15th, and the payments probably won't go out until September because they have to change some things in the unemployment system to get these payments to people. Kentucky will have to use some of its CARES Act money to give people the full $400 benefit. And so a lot of states are using a federal $300 benefit, but Kentucky is giving an extra $100 per person out of CARES Act money to give people the full $400 additional benefit to their unemployment. So that's good news for people who are still, you know, laid off, out of work, or furloughed. Bashir also announced this week that there will be a $15 million relief fund for home renters that are at risk of eviction. So under the program, landlords must give tenants 30 days notice before they can start eviction proceedings. During these 30 days, the landlord and the tenant must meet and confer, and the notice that they give to the tenant has to request that meeting. No penalties or late fees can be assessed from March 6th up through the end of this year on December 30th. And the money for this program will also come from our CARES Act funding. And so, you know, where the relief comes in is this money will be used to reimburse landlords for missed rental payments. It's unclear if people who are already in eviction proceedings, since evictions were allowed to resume August 1st, it's unclear if they're going to be able to receive relief and stay in their homes. And so, while I'm glad we have some relief for home renters, I feel like it's a little late for it. And I hope that the people who are already at risk of losing their shelter, you know, can get some of this funding. And maybe we should have planned for it a little bit earlier. I know the governor's been busy, though. So I know that he's had to make a lot of really tough decisions and figure out how to use our funding that we've gotten from the federal government. Also, Secretary of State Michael Adams and Governor Bashir's voting plan has been approved. And as of this week, you can now request your absentee ballot at govoteky.com. Robert and I talked about this last week, and we both said that we would probably do early voting this time around. Getting an absentee ballot was a little stressful to me last time, like waiting and seeing if it showed up on time and then wondering if it made it. So that, what do you think, how do you think you will vote this year?
Probably the way that I always do. I like to be able to go and do it in person.
Yeah, so you voted in person in the June primary at the fairgrounds, right?
Yes. I got up really early. I don't know why. I think it's because I am not like a, I have some sort of irrational distrust for technology. So I wanted to actually like physically tender my ballot, and that's just what I'm comfortable with. And I mean, if I couldn't do that, I would certainly do something else, but that's my plan.
Yeah, I think the reason I want to vote in person this time through either early voting or going the day of, I'll probably try to do it early to avoid crowds, But I think right now everything that's going on with the post office funding makes me nervous about mail delays because I was already cutting it close getting my ballot last time. So I think I'm going to do it in person this time as well. Lastly, for COVID news, some sports updates. U of L announced it would allow up to 18,000 fans at Cardinal Stadium for football. Their typical capacity is just over 60,000, so that's about one-third capacity. You know, I don't think we should have fans for sports right now. I guess one-third is better than more than that, but hopefully people can stay safe if they're going to go to football games.
Are they going to do, like, temperature checks and screenings at the entry?
I'm not sure what their measures are yet, and I don't know if they have a plan in place for that. You know, I'm sure that they will ask people to wear masks, but whether there's any kind of enforcement for that, I think it's really hard to enforce at something like a football game where there's 18,000 people.
Will they have the concessions open?
I would say that they probably would, but I don't know what their regulations are going to be, and UK hasn't announced what their plan is either. So as we get closer to the season, in the next few weeks, we'll see what happens. And finally, the KHSAA voted to go forward with the plan to begin fall sports on time, and Andy Beshear did not seem thrilled about it. But a group of over 100 people rallied in Frankfurt on Monday in support of holding fall sports, and Senator Max Wise, who actually had COVID, he spoke at the event in support. And ultimately, I think this was just like a fight that the governor didn't want to pick. He seemed very disappointed to let them go on with their plan, but was kind of like, it's on you all. You know, you all are the governing body and you've made this decision, so I'll let you all roll with it. But I think he's trying to like wash his hands of, you know, I don't condone it, but go ahead. That's the COVID news for this week. And our next story, of course, are the protests around the state. And first, we've got to start with some Daniel Cameron news because there's been a lot of Daniel Cameron news over the last week. The first thing that happened after we recorded last week was the seniors took to protesting. So last week, several senior citizens set in at Daniel Cameron's house to protest police brutality and the killing of Breonna Taylor. Several were given citations, and one woman, Mary Holden, who is 68 years old, was arrested. She was actually, they asked her to leave, and she kept knitting. So I like Mary. So seven total received citations, and only Ms. Holden was arrested after refusing to leave. They all have court dates later this fall. So we will see if the county attorney's office will prosecute them. What do you think might be done with these cases?
I can tell you what I hope will happen.
Yeah.
I hope that this isn't something that is prosecuted to the full extent of the law. I think that while I legally understand the citations, I think that it's so inspiring to see people, elderly people, so active in this movement. It's not at all surprising because, like we were talking about earlier, this has been going on since we've been around. I think it's inspiring and encouraging, and I hope that the prosecutors will exercise their discretion and find a way to maybe work out some sort of dismissal, honestly.
Yeah, and I've seen at least one head prosecutor in another state make a blanket decision that they wouldn't prosecute low-level, like, protest-related offenses, that they would dismiss all the misdemeanor charges, basically. And I would really hope to see our county attorney, Mike O'Connell, do something
similar.
Was this similar.
A trespass charge? I know that in the past,
I think they're charged with trespass and maybe either failure to disperse or disorderly conduct. Okay. So they're all misdemeanors.
But none of the felony.
None of the felony charges that we saw for intimidating a witness last time protested at his house.
So no matter what you think about the message, the fact is that these are very, very low-level offenses.
Yeah.
So these people should not be getting the book thrown at them at all, like by any means.
Yeah, absolutely. So our next Daniel Cameron story is McGrath versus Cameron. So this past week, Amy McGrath called for Daniel Cameron to release the Breonna Taylor investigation or turn it over to someone else. She said, "The Attorney General has failed to convey to the public that his office is making this investigation a priority. In fact, he has failed to communicate much at all with the public about this case." And I think Amy McGrath's statement is a pretty fair criticism because he said little to nothing about it, and we keep seeing all these other things that he's been doing instead of, you know, talking about the Breonna Taylor investigation. We've seen him filing COVID regulation lawsuits against the governor. We've seen him speaking at the Republican National Convention. If you are on Twitter, he's been taking pictures with like Attorney General William Barr this past week, and we've seen him having engagement parties and getting married. And so I do think it's a fair criticism to say, I don't see that you've made this a priority. But I also think at the same time that Daniel Cameron had a decent response to Amy McGrath. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did see it.
I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read the first like two sentences of it. He released an official statement that said, "I appreciate candidate McGrath's sudden interest in the investigation into the death of Ms. Taylor. I know Senator McConnell, Charles Booker, and others have been concerned and interested from the beginning." And then he goes on, "As I've said, we're very committed to a thorough investigation."
Blah, I know blah. Booker has.
As
far as clapping back, that's the part I am cool with him saying, like, I know Booker's been down with this since the beginning.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, how much Senator McConnell's been concerned about it, but I do think it was, like, a good burn on Amy McGrath when he called it her sudden interest.
It is sudden.
Because she has been criticized for, you know, not coming to Louisville when the protests started. I definitely think, you know, her response has been kind of delayed, and maybe with a new campaign manager, they decided this was, you know, the way to go is to attack Cameron about it. But I do think that he had a sick burn back to Amy McGrath. The last thing with Daniel Cameron, he also spoke at the Republican National Convention last night. And I think from, you know, the media response and social media, it's very clear that he's a rising star in the National Republican Party. I think everyone in Kentucky saw him as this, you know, rising Republican star in the state, but now he's getting a more national stage.
I don't think everybody in Kentucky saw him as that. I think people who knew he was connected to Mitch McConnell expected it. But I think there are a lot of people that are like, who is Daniel Cameron?
Yeah, you're probably right. You know, I'm kind of in this, like, very political bubble. And I think, you know, if you follow politics closely or you listen to the show regularly, we all knew he was the McConnell protege.
Right.
But I think now other people are starting to see that he's going to be a big name in the future in the Republican Party. His big line from his speech, he said, "I often think about my ancestors who struggled for freedom. And as I think of those giants and their broad shoulders, I also think about Joe Biden, who says, if you aren't voting for me, you ain't black. Mr. Vice President, look at me. I am black. We are not all the same, sir. My mind is my own, and you cannot tell me how to vote because of the color of my skin." You know, I actually think this is a fair criticism of Joe Biden.
I do too.
Yeah. And I think it was the exact right thing for him to say. Cameron,
and I think he meant it.
Yeah. And Cameron,
that was probably the only thing I think he meant.
So you've seen Daniel Cameron's remarks. What did you think in general of his speech?
Well, other than that part, I think that he was very well rehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
I think he hit all the buzzwords. And I think he talked a big game. He talked a lot
about
how Biden, I think, was he saying backwards thinking? Or?
Yeah, he did say backwards thinking.
And how we should be forward thinking. So I want to see him put his money where his mouth, or our money where his mouth is, and live up to what he obviously thinks Trump has done. After seeing him talk, I think that he's talked a big game, and I expect that he'll do something.
Yeah. So speaking of doing something, he also said Breonna Taylor's name, and we've been waiting on you know, his findings from the investigation into her death. He was talking about, so he said, even as anarchists mindlessly tear up American cities while attacking police and innocent bystanders, we Republicans do recognize those who work in good faith towards peace, justice, and equality. Whether you're the family of Breonna Taylor or David Dorn, these are the ideals that will heal our nation's wounds. Republicans will never turn a blind eye to unjust acts, but neither will we accept an all-out assault on Western civilization. This part, to me, I have a hard time believing that Republicans as a whole will never turn a blind eye to unjust acts. But I think, you know, if you're going to invoke Breonna Taylor's name, I hope that we're going to hear something about his investigation soon.
I don't think that he presented as somebody who was compassionate or excited about this forward-thinking progress that he was talking about. It, to me, came off as...
just felt like
buzzwords.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to stand here and be a politician. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I think he talked a big game, and I think it's perfectly reasonable for him to now know that people expect that he is going to back it up.
Yeah, definitely. So our last topic related to the protests has been BreonnaCon. So last week we talked about a multi-day event that would be put on by Until Freedom that would be called BreonnaCon. It's taken place over the last few days, and it was kind of met with mixed reviews. So some local organizers and activists have expressed that Until Freedom and the celebrities that came with them are interfering with local work that's being done. I understand that criticism because we have a lot of people in Louisville that have been doing this work for a long time. Many of the flyers for events had like big photos of celebrities who would be speaking with like faded background photos of Breonna. And you know, most of the events like bore her name in some way. You know, activists and other people on social media were also critical of that because a lot of these events had her name, but they didn't directly relate to achieving justice for her. One of the events was called Tailor Made, and the theme of it was beauty, money, and justice. And they, you know, handed out like sample makeup bags and things like that. They said that everything that they gave away had been donated, but a lot of local community leaders felt like they were cheapening her name. And I think that that is a fair criticism based on the flyers that I saw. Chanel Helm, who is a leader of Black Lives Matter Louisville, she said that she had conversations with Until Freedom about how to amplify local activists without taking over, but that she felt that her advice fell on deaf ears and they kind of like stepped away from working with Until Freedom. Some of the others who criticized the group, Ja'Cory Arthur, who has recently been elected to Metro Council, and his campaign manager, Breonna Wright, also pulled out of events after they saw the branding and consulted with some other community leaders. But, you know, there were some local activists who supported what they were doing here and were glad to have their help. So I think it was definitely met with mixed sentiment. Tamika Mallory, who's the co-founder of Until Freedom, said that they had the full support of Breonna Taylor's family. You know, so I don't know how they feel about it, but that's what their co-founder has expressed. Lastly, BreonnaCon culminated in a Tuesday march near Churchill Downs. After they passed the track, the protesters were met with heavy police presence at an overpass near Cardinal Stadium, and 64 protesters were eventually arrested. You know, I saw tons of live videos, and from everything I saw, this was a completely peaceful protest, no confrontations, but 64 people were still arrested for, you know, like failure to disperse and blocking the roadway. All but one of them, as best that I've heard, have been released on their own recognizance, but we have a lot of new protesters charged with misdemeanor offenses. All right, so that's all we have for this week. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at MyOldKYPod. You can like our Facebook page. You can listen to our podcast on the podcast app of your choice. We also have a newsletter that comes out on Fridays. We partner with Forward Kentucky to do that. You can subscribe to it at forwardky.com/email. And we have a Patreon page. You can support what we're doing for as little as a dollar a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And when Robert gets back, we're going to have some exciting stuff going on with our Patreon. So be sure to stay tuned for that. And last but not least, we are part of the Demcast Network. So Yvette, thank you so much for coming back and talking with us. All right, we'll see you next week.
Folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry, all happy and bright. By and by, hard times comes a